within classical liberal economic theory, raising the minimum wage, massive programs for rebuilding infrastructure, better safety nets, early childhood education and better education in general, better health care, and so on. These would help ease the pain on the non-wealthy, and that is a vitally important thing to do. But can liberal economic measures alone overcome runaway accumulation for the rich and runaway loss for the non-rich? Even to get these easing the pain measures, the political climate would have to change radically. And, as we have seen, just telling people the Piketty economic facts cannot help, because the Piketty facts will not have real effects without radical framing change. What's wrong with runaway accumulation? The major, thus far unframed effect is that runaway exponential accumulation of wealth share tends to kill off the provision of public resources that makes a satisfying and healthy private life possible. The political effect of runaway wealth is, for example, to cut taxes on the wealthy, taking away funding for the public resources that made that wealth possible in the first place. Take university education. There are only so many top research universities. A number of them are public. By cutting funding to such public universities, these public resources have to raise tuition and other costs, and so move away from really being public toward being private. The same goes for education at all levels. At the same time, real education is being lost. The point of a classic liberal education was manifold: to develop one's mind and critical faculties in general, to teach about the world so as to open a world of possibilities in life, to provide skills for learning whatever one needs to learn, and to create citizens who contribute to a democratic society. Because of the runaway loss of satisfying work, education has radically changed. More and more students see education as a direct route to either wealth or a satisfying work life, and are therefore getting educated for today's jobs without the intangible but vitally important personal riches of a liberal education. That is educational robbery, because a liberal education opens up possibilities for one's entire life that an orientation toward today's jobs does not, especially when today's jobs may not be there in the future. The runaway loss of valuable experiences. If those of great wealth own the beaches, it means all others are deprived of the experience of them. Access, for most people, is cut off. The loss is a loss of experience. This is true not only of beaches, but also of many things that the ultra-rich can experience, but that the lower middle class and poor cannot. Excellent schools, pleasant surroundings, summer camps, trips to lovely or interesting places, the ability to visit family, time off from work, expensive art or music events, nice clothes, great food and wine, healthy food, first-rate medical care, major athletic events, world cultures, great cities, film festivals, and on and on. Money buys experiences of personal value, what a lot of life is about. A single wealthy person can only experience so much. The runaway accumulation of wealth for the rich and the runaway loss of wealth for others means that for most people a runaway loss of experiences of personal value, the loss of a meaningful life. Piketty and global warming. The rise of runaway wealth accumulation at the same time as intensifying global warming has created the perfect storm, and these concepts need to be linked in political discourse. Wealthy corporations and individuals keep reinvesting and getting wealthier. The current framing of global warming in the conservative and often the mainstream media uses both denial and scare tactics, like claiming that addressing global warming is too expensive, would ruin the economy, cost massive job layoffs, increase energy dependency, and so on. These are all false claims, as independent studies have shown. But when the wealthy control what appears in the public media, they can control public discourse and public thought mechanisms through the control of language and imagery. And the worse global warming effects get, the greater the pain on the middle and lower classes, while the effects of global warming can be more easily withstood by those with great wealth. Global warming is the greatest moral issue facing our generation. Accelerating wealth accumulation by the wealthy is a close runner-up. Today, they present a clear and present danger, not just to the United States, but to the world. Growth. There is a major systemic effect of framing the Piketty insight in terms of inequality alone and not thinking about how it relates to global warming and other major issues, like the pressure for continued economic growth. Piketty is arguing within traditional economic theory. He estimates that R can, in principle, with the right politics, be kept less than G, economic growth measured in terms of GDP, if economic growth G is kept below 2% per year. But growth is compounded and therefore exponential too. Economic growth means population growth, growth in the use of resources, growth in global warming, growth in weather disasters, and growth in the diminishment of the natural world. Over 50 years, even 2% growth is huge. Once one starts talking about global warming, growth itself becomes an issue. Population growth, growth in worldwide production for and by that population, growth in food needs, growth in energy needs, growth in natural resource needs, and so on. Fossil fuel use has to be reversed to avoid global warming disasters. An economy based on growth, even as low as 2% in all these areas, would not prevent a global warming disaster. Models for a new sustainable, that is, non-growth economics are being developed. How does the Piketty insight square with such economic models, if it does at all? That is a systemic causation question that needs to be asked. For example, the main factor in population growth appears to be women's education and the availability and use of contraception. Women's education is affected by poverty, but every bit as much by religion. Religions like Catholicism and Islamism promote population growth, which makes it harder to control global warming. It isn't just whether R is higher than G. The intertwined systemic effects. One of the main take-home points of this book is that framing can have massive systemic effects. The absence of adequate framing can have just as massive effects. Framing the Piketty insight as just about inequality misses most of what we have just discussed. It misses the systemic effects. Framing is about thought, about understanding at the deepest levels, about circuitry in your brain with strong synapses that last, about changing unconscious, automatic, effortless understanding. In other words, about changing common sense. Frame change itself is a systemic effect. There are a lot of frames to be changed. How can such overall change be affected? It begins by strengthening the framing for the progressive moral system and for the progressive view of democracy based around empathy and the responsibility flowing from that empathy. In other words, we have to care about others, fellow citizens of the world we have never met and never will meet, and recognize the fact that the private depends on the public. That in turn depends on another systemic effect, the effect of language and the brain on public discourse, and the failure in universities to teach that effect. Chapter 9. Government by Corporation. As we have seen, there is much that is unframed by the general public that needs to be framed. Most notably, runaway wealth to the wealthy. The wealth share of the most wealthy is growing exponentially, and the wealth share of others is correspondingly declining. In the absence of adequate framing, most people feel the effects but don't comprehend the systemic causes. Runaway climate disasters. The Earth is warming dangerously and quickly, and that warming is systemically causing climate disasters, including extreme cold. Without understanding systemic effects, extreme cold leads to the denial of global warming. Runaway privatization of public resources. The private depends on the public, but conservatives are drastically cutting funds for public resources while successfully promoting privatization. They say that government doesn't work, and by cutting funds they can make government cease to work. And by cutting government resources for all, they can make democracy cease to work. But there is another important framing that is beginning to catch on. The Constitution applies only to human beings. Conceptual metaphors have no legal standing. We normally think using thousands of them, but the law does not overtly give them any official role in the law itself. So far as the law is concerned, metaphorical thought, which is ubiquitous, does not exist. But in reality, unconscious conceptual metaphors do exist. They are everywhere, and they have consequences. This disparity between the law and the human brain and mind is unframed, not part of most people's everyday consciousness or discourse. At the same time, a major metaphor has entered into the national consciousness because of certain Supreme Court decisions, that corporations are persons with constitutional rights. Reflexivity enters here. Decisions made by our courts have the power to turn metaphors into facts on the ground, as in this example. Those metaphors taken as facts give rise to further court decisions extending those metaphors. The power to turn metaphors into facts can be an awesome power, a power with enormous political impact. The corporations are persons metaphor has so great a political impact that it is worth some discussion here. Let's begin, though, by looking at two powerful metaphors that form its roots. Cognitive scientists who study metaphorical thought have recognized two common metaphors which we adopt unconsciously and automatically that are relevant here. Metaphor 1. Pluralities are groups. The pluralities are groups metaphor attributes group properties to separate individuals, whether warranted or not. The result is that the group is perceived as an entity with different properties than the individuals in it. Take a look at the two operative words. A plurality consists of people, animals, plants, or other things considered separately, ungrouped. A number of people may be riding on the subway, for instance, but aside from being on the same subway, they are not necessarily part of any particular group. They are a plurality, but they need not have common characteristics, goals, or functions. A group is an entity conceptualized metaphorically as a container for other entities. The group can, and usually does, have properties, resources, goals, and functions that are separate from the individual entities in the group. Once we combine the two metaphorically, we begin to think about pluralities differently. For example, a club, a church, an association, for example, the AARP, the American Association of Retired Persons, can have money, a home, legal responsibilities and liabilities, they can be sued or a lien can be placed against their property, that don't apply to any individual members. Similarly, corporations can be sued while their stockholders can be immune to such lawsuits as individuals. Metaphor 2. Institutions are persons. Ask most people if institutions are people, and they will say no. In fact, our definition of the two words are quite distinct. An institution is an abstract entity conceptualized metaphorically as a container for people. An institution is typically defined by its goals, resources, and by various functions, responsibilities, and privileges for whatever people are in the institution. The institution is defined independently of the people who happen to be in it, serving its functions. A person is a human being. Human beings have goals and resources and typically have responsibilities, privileges, and carry out functions. Human beings also have properties that institutions do not have. Human bodies and brains, feelings and emotions, desires and beliefs, physical functions and needs, as well as social roles and the ability to think and communicate. But this conceptual metaphor has long been in our brains. We use this metaphorical mode of thought constantly when we are comprehending and discussing institutions, as in, the EPA was disappointed by the court ruling. Major League Baseball wants to wipe out the use of performance-enhancing drugs. Stanford thinks that online courses are a good idea. Berkeley is troubled by rape on campus. Planned Parenthood was disgusted by the recent court decision, and so on. These two conceptual metaphors, pluralities are groups and institutions are persons, exist in many parts of the world and have for millennia, and in many cases they have been recognized in law. Roman law recognized certain businesses and religious groups as institutions with the properties of human beings, goals, resources, functions, responsibilities, and privileges. Today, we still attribute these properties of human beings metaphorically to institutions. There is a long history of just what properties of human beings are attributed metaphorically to institutions. For example, the medieval church saw monasteries as institutions with goals, finances, responsibilities, and privileges, but differing from people in that they lacked a soul. In England, companies were institutions given exclusive rights or charters to do business for the financial benefit of their shareholders and the British Crown. One of the most successful was the East India Company. The Massachusetts Bay Colony was founded by the owners of the Massachusetts Bay Company, which had a charter to do business in the New England area. The metaphorical idea that a government is a business came to America in 1623 with the Massachusetts Bay Company and has been part of American political life ever since. Before 1819, the commonplace conceptual metaphor that institutions are persons began to be applied to corporations and was limited to such matters as goals, finances, responsibilities, privileges, and so on. But there is a difference between this very common and limited view of corporate personhood and a view that gave corporations constitutional rights. That took the corporations are persons metaphor out of range of normal conceptual metaphor and into the power of the courts. In 1819, the Supreme Court made a fateful decision in Trustees of Dartmouth College versus Woodward. Before the American Revolution, King George III granted a corporate charter to Dartmouth College, giving it land in New Hampshire and giving the trustees the right to administer the college. In 1819, the trustees deposed the college president. The New Hampshire legislature was outraged and passed legislation taking away the college's charter from King George, putting the state in charge, and, in effect, making Dartmouth a state college. The trustees brought a case against the state, with Daniel Webster arguing their case passionately before the Supreme Court and Chief Justice John Marshall. The court ruled, even though all political ties had been severed with King George, the charter still constituted a contract with King George the person. The court held that this contract fell under the Contracts Clause of the Constitution, which forbids a state to pass laws overturning contracts. Though the provision in the Constitution applied to contracts among persons, the court held that it applied to corporations as well. Dartmouth remained private and under the control of the trustees. Meanwhile, a line had been crossed. A constitutional clause granting rights of contract and property to persons now applied to corporations. And an institution, the British monarchy, called metonymically the British Crown, was now taken literally to be a person, King George. In 1868, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments were passed, making slaves free, giving them equal protection under the law and guaranteeing them the right to vote. The first clause of the 14th Amendment reads, "All persons born or naturalized in the United States, and all subjects to the jurisdiction thereof, are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. Nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws." In the years leading up to these amendments, large industries, banks, and railroads took corporate form and became rich and powerful. Many states set about regulating them and restricting their powers. With the passage of the 14th Amendment intended as protection for former slaves, railroads saw a way around these restrictions. They assumed the opposite of the pluralities or groups metaphor, which separated the properties of group entities from the individual properties of their members. The new groups or pluralities metaphor identified the properties of the group with properties of the members. They began arguing that corporations were persons and had as one of their properties the same constitutional protections as persons had. They argued this for nearly 20 years and kept losing. But they got the idea into public discourse, especially among people employed by the railroads. Then in 1886 they got a break. The railroads had brought 4 cases concerning taxes to the Supreme Court, including Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad. In Santa Clara County, there was a tax provision that allowed persons paying mortgages on their property to deduct the amount of their mortgages from their taxes. Southern Pacific Railroad had a huge mortgage and wanted its mortgage costs deducted from its taxes, which would make a lot of profit for the railroad and cost Santa Clara County a lot of tax money. The case was argued in the Supreme Court with Chief Justice Morris Waite presiding. Waite had earlier been a railroad lawyer. The court recorder was J.C. Bancroft Davis, formerly president of a small railroad. The precedent of corporate personhood came out of this case. But the precedent did not come from any argument in the case or anything written in favor or against by any of the justices. The precedent came from an oral remark by Chief Justice Waite that was taken down by court reporter J.C. Bancroft Davis. The remark appeared in the headnotes for the case and nowhere else. The headnote quoted Waite as saying, "The court does not wish to hear argument on the question whether the provision in the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, which forbids any state to deny any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws, applies to these corporations. We are of the opinion that it does." That set the precedent, which was then cited in succeeding cases. Bear in mind, as we go through the list of cases, that British common law defined corporations and their shareholders in such a way as to legally separate the properties of the shareholders from the properties of the corporation, so that the shareholders were free of certain liabilities of the corporations. Hence the LLC, the Limited Liability Corporation. Each of the following court decisions violated this essential property of corporations by automatically attributing to corporations certain of the constitutional rights held by shareholders. namely constitutional rights of due process, free speech, seen as money contributed to political campaigns and spent on the media, freedom of religion, and freedom from unreasonable search and seizure and double jeopardy. Bear in mind the Mitt Romney quote from the 2012 presidential election. "Corporations are people, my friend. Everything corporations earn eventually goes to people." He neglected to say which people. In 1889, the court overtly granted due process protections of the 14th Amendment to corporations. In 1893, it was Fifth Amendment protections of double jeopardy. In 1906, Fourth Amendment protections from unreasonable search and seizure. And in 1978, the First Amendment right to make contributions to ballot initiative campaigns. In the latter case, the metaphor was extended. Though a corporation could not go to the polls and vote, as a person it has the right of free speech since its shareholders have the right of free speech. Then a further metaphor. Speech as money going to campaigns. Not for candidates, real people, but for policies affecting corporations. It was a step toward Citizens United. Interestingly, Citizens United is not directly about corporate personhood and does not depend on that general metaphor. It depends instead on two other metaphors. Money is speech. Non-persons have the right to speech. These two metaphors form a logic. People have a right to as much speech as they want. Since money is speech and non-persons have the right to speech, it follows that non-persons have the right to spend as much money as they want on elections. This 5-4 vote by a conservative court was politically motivated. Corporations have much more money to spend on political campaigns than do unions. This ruling gives a huge amount of money to conservatives and hardly any to progressives. Speech, as we have seen, is not just sounding off. If framed and targeted carefully, Citizens United allows conservatives to change the brains of biconceptuals and win a lot of elections for conservatives and move the country radically to the right. The Hobby Lobby and Wheaton cases were conservative victories as well. The Hobby Lobby verdict granted First Amendment freedom of religion rights to corporations that are tightly held and operated by a family or small group, more than half controlled by at most 5 persons. The right given is a new right. To ignore a provision of a law applying to a corporation if the small group of individuals owning or controlling the corporation feel that the law violates their religious principles. This is a new and very different metaphorical extension of corporations are persons to First Amendment rights, and it opens the floodgates to a huge range of claims to be exempt from provisions of the law on grounds of religious principle as self-defined. In short, it puts corporations above the law. It is a step toward legalizing government by corporations. This is a radical conservative political decision. Why? Because radical conservatives want to eliminate public resources and public aspects of government. That is, government by laws passed by human legislators. At once, this shifts government from the public to the private sphere and from the human to the non-human sphere. This brings us to another truth unframed in public discourse. Corporations govern our lives. There have been many great innovations made by corporations when they have invested their exponentially accumulated wealth in innovations that improve people's lives. In useful computer technology, telecommunications, pharmaceuticals and medical equipment, transportation, in area after area. To my knowledge, in all cases, these innovations that have improved our lives were ultimately made possible by public resources. Government-sponsored research and university training made possible computer science, satellites, medical research and training, and so on in case after case. Every great corporate innovation story simply burnishes the truth that the private depends on the public. But what is left conceptually unframed and therefore unspoken are the negative effects of the runaway accumulation of corporate wealth. Here is a short list. Increasing corporate lobbying and political contributions. These effects work largely against the public interest on a huge range of issues, even to the extent that corporations write laws introduced by the legislators they contribute to. The Citizens United decision greatly exacerbated this effect. Increasing externalization of costs. The wealthier corporations get, the more power they have to use their political influence to avoid regulations. As a result, they can pass along to others the costs of doing business, and thus increase profits even more. The fancy name for this is externalization of costs. A prime example is the dumping of hazardous waste that taxpayers will pay to clean up, or will suffer with. Consider what happens when fracking companies dump pools of polluted water on the landscape, or tear up the land in the fracking process and then leave it torn up, or inject vast amounts of poisonous chemicals in the porous shale rock next to the water table, thus creating polluted drinking and agricultural water. The burden is shifted away from the private corporations and to the public. The prime example, of course, is of corporations emitting the greenhouse gas pollution that has caused global warming. The costs get dumped onto you, whether you're paying more taxes to mitigate climate change or to clean up after severe storms, or you're paying more for vegetables during severe droughts. But even when you have to spend your time searching a company website or waiting on the phone to talk to a customer service representative, costs are being externalized. Your time is being spent while the company profits by hiring too few people in customer service. Various forms of self-service at gas stations, supermarkets, and big box stores are made to sound like conveniences for you, but they are really ways of making you work for the company for free. Increasing costs to consumers due to monopoly ownership. For example, some internet providers with no competition may overcharge and provide minimal service, leaving the customer to bear the burden of exorbitant costs and poor service. Limitations of size options by clothing manufacturers. Many clothing manufacturers will only make sizes that fit the most normally sized people because it is more profitable than providing sizes for the full range of customers. Increasingly unethical business practices. For example, General Motors sold cars with known defects that caused deaths, while people in the company knew of the dangers and kept silent. Increasing corporate inefficiency. Anyone who has worked in a large company is familiar with corporate inefficiency. See the Dilbert comic strip. Health insurance companies, for example, have inefficiency costs that are very high compared with Medicare. Those inefficiency costs are transferred to consumers whenever possible. Increasing corporate management pay and the pressure for short-term profits. When the very rich get exponentially richer and everyone else exponentially loses access to wealth, there is an inevitable pressure for short-term profits. When corporate managers are in charge of managing corporate wealth, there is an incentive for them to acquire exponentially growing wealth. To a large extent, corporations govern us and run our lives, for their profit, not ours. The list could go on and on. To a large extent, the runaway expropriation of wealth pointed out by Thomas Piketty is the result of government by corporation. Piketty points out that a political solution is necessary, but when our politics is governed significantly through lobbying by corporations rather than the public, the possibility of this is greatly reduced. Conservatives like to rail against government as taking away their liberty. But government by corporations probably does far more to take away such liberty. Government by corporation is a major, unframed reality. It is systemically linked to the runaway accumulation of our wealth by the very wealthy. Because of the systemic effect of runaway personal and corporate wealth on our politics, both are systemically linked to the threat of global warming to the future of our planet, and to the fundamental split in our politics that is systemically threatening democracy in ways that are not obvious, and are therefore also unframed in public discourse. Part 4. Framing. Looking back a decade. Chapter 10. What's in a word? Plenty if it's marriage. February 18, 2004, with some updates in 2014. The original version of this chapter was written over a decade ago, before the major advances in the acceptance of gay marriage. The successful strategy used what was recommended in this chapter in the first edition of this book. The stress on love and commitment and the generalization to everyone, not just gays. More than half of Americans now support gay marriage. It is legal in 19 states. But there is still a long way to go in the other 31 states. The conservative framing has not changed. It's against the Bible. It threatens the very definition of marriage. It's a lifestyle choice. Children will be lured into it. It's all about sex. Conservatives these days repeat the word homosexual, which contains the word sex, and the slur homo. For example, Texas Governor Rick Perry was reported as saying, "Whether or not you feel compelled to follow a particular lifestyle or not, you have the ability to decide not to do that. I may have the genetic coding that I'm inclined to be an alcoholic, but I have the desire not to do that, and I look at the homosexual issue the same way." For all of that, conservatives are fighting a losing battle against love and commitment, family and community. The younger generation is overwhelmingly accepting. President Obama entered the presidency not being in favor of gay marriage, but being open to evolving on the issue. He has now evolved. The evolution metaphor suggests an adaptation to the changing political context. What's in a word? Plenty if the word is marriage. Marriage is central to our culture. Marriage legally confers many hundreds of benefits, but that is only its material aspect. Marriage is an institution, the public expression of lifelong commitment based on love. It is the culmination of a period of seeking a mate, and for many the realization of a major goal, often with a buildup of dreams, dates, gossip, anxiety, engagement, a shower, wedding plans, rituals, invitations, a bridal gown, bridesmaids, families coming together, vows, and a honeymoon. Marriage is the beginning of family life, commonly with the expectation of children and grandchildren, family gatherings, in-laws, little league games, graduations, and all the rest. Marriage is also understood in terms of dozens of deep and abiding metaphors. A journey through life together, a partnership, a union, a bond, a single object of complementary parts, a haven, a means for growth, a sacrament, a home. Marriage confers a social status. A married couple with new social roles. And for a great many people, marriage legitimizes sex. In short, marriage is a big deal. In arguing against same-sex marriage, the conservatives are using two powerful ideas, definition and sanctity. We must take them back. We have to fight definition with definition and sanctity with sanctity. As anthropological studies of American marriage have shown, they got the definition wrong. Marriage as an ideal is defined as the realization of love through a lifelong public commitment. Love is sacred in America. So is commitment. There is sanctity in marriage. It is the sanctity of love and commitment. Like most important concepts, marriage also comes with a variety of prototypical cases. The ideal marriage is happy, lasting, prosperous, and with children, a nice home, and friendships with other married couples. The typical marriage has its ups and downs, its joys and difficulties, typical problems with children and in-laws. The nightmare marriage ends in divorce, due perhaps to incompatibility, abuse, or betrayal. It is a rich concept. None of the riches we have just discussed requires marriage to be heterosexual. Not its definition, its sanctity, its rituals, its family life, its hopes and dreams. The locus of the idea that marriage is heterosexual is in a widespread cultural stereotype. In evoking this stereotype, language is important. The radical right used to say gay marriage. Now it's homosexual marriage. One reason, I believe, is that marriage evokes the idea of sex. And most Americans do not favor sex that isn't heterosexual. The stereotype of marriage is heterosexual. Gay, for the right, connotes a wild, deviant, sexually irresponsible lifestyle. But gay marriage is a double-edged sword. President Bush chose not to use the words gay marriage in a State of the Union address. I suspect that the omission occurred for a good reason. His position was that marriage is defined as being between a man and a woman, and so the term gay marriage should be an oxymoron, as meaningless as gay apple or gay telephone. The more gay marriage is used, the more normal the idea of same-sex marriage becomes, and the clearer it becomes that marriage is not defined to exclude the very possibility. The grammar is important. Gay is grammatically a modifier specifying a kind of marriage. If you understand the expression, then it is not a contradiction in terms and marriage is not defined to exclude gays. Because marriage is central to family life, it has a political dimension. As I discussed earlier and at greater length in my book Moral Politics, conservative and progressive politics are organized around two very different models of married life, a strict father family and a nurturant parent family. The strict father is moral authority and master of the household, dominating the mother and children and imposing needed discipline. Contemporary conservative politics turns these family values into political values, hierarchical authority, individual discipline, military might. Marriage in the strict father family must be heterosexual marriage. The father is manly, strong, decisive, dominating, a role model for sons and for daughters, a model of a man to look up to. The nurturant parent model has two equal partners, whose job is to nurture their children and teach their children to nurture others. Nurturance has two dimensions, empathy and responsibility, for oneself and others. Responsibility requires strength and competence. The strong, nurturing parent is protective and caring, builds trust and connection, promotes family happiness and fulfillment, fairness, freedom, openness, cooperation, and community development. These are the values of strong progressive politics. Though the stereotype is again heterosexual, there is nothing in the nurturant family model to rule out same-sex marriage. In a society divided down the middle by these two family models and their politics, we can see why the issue of same-sex marriage is so volatile. What is at stake is more than the material benefits of marriage and the use of the word. At stake are one's identity and most central values. This is not just about same-sex couples. It is about which values will dominate in our society. When conservatives speak of the defense of marriage, liberals are baffled. After all, no individual's marriage is being threatened. It's just that more marriages are being allowed. But conservatives see the strict father family and with it their political values as under attack. They are right. This is a serious matter for their politics and moral values as a whole. Even civil unions are threatening, since they create families that cannot be traditional strict father families. Progressives are of two minds. Pragmatic liberals see the issue as one of benefits. Inheritance, health care, adoption, and so forth. If that's all that is involved, civil unions should be sufficient. And they certainly were in advance. Civil unions provided equal material protection under the law. Why not leave civil unions to the state and marriage to the churches, as in Vermont, the first state of many to adopt civil unions and later same-sex marriages? Idealistic progressives saw beyond the material benefits, important as they are. Most gay activists want full-blown marriage with all its cultural meanings, a public commitment based on love, all the metaphors, all the rituals, joys, heartaches, family experiences, and a sense of normality on par with all other people. The issue is one of personal freedom. The state should not dictate who should marry whom. It is also a matter of fairness and human dignity. Equality under the law includes social and cultural as well as material benefits. The slogan here is freedom to marry. Back in 2004, when the first edition of Don't Think of an Elephant was published, a number of prominent Democrats claimed that marriage was a matter for the church, while the proper role for the state was civil unions and a guarantee of material benefits. This argument has always made little sense to me. The ability of ministers, priests, and rabbis to perform marriage ceremonies is granted by governments, not by religions. And civil marriage is normal and widespread. Besides, it will only satisfy the pragmatic liberals. Idealistic conservatives will see civil unions as tantamount to marriage, and idealistic progressives will see them as falling far short of equal protection. And what of the constitutional amendment to legally define marriage as between a man and a woman? Conservatives will be for it, and many others with a heterosexual stereotype of marriage may support it. But with 19 states legalizing gay marriage and a majority of Americans for it, such an amendment is now dead in the water. Progressives have reclaimed the moral high ground of the grand American tradition of freedom, fairness, human dignity, and full equality under the law. There is no longer a need to talk about civil unions and just the material benefits. The job of ordinary citizens in the remaining 31 states is to reframe the debate in everything we say and write in terms of our moral principles. With the divorce rate for heterosexual marriage skyrocketing, the sanctity of marriage is more important than ever. Talk sanctity. With love and commitment, you have the very definition of the marital ideal, of what marriage is fundamentally about. Any couple willing to fight for a public recognition of their love and a lifetime commitment has sanctity on their side. We all have to put our ideas out there so that political candidates can readily refer to them. For example, when there is a discussion in your office, church, or other group, there is a simple response for someone who says, "I don't think gays should be able to marry, do you?" The response is, "I believe in equal rights, period. I don't think the state should be in the business of telling people who they can or can't marry. Marriage is about love and commitment. and denying the right to marry to people in love who want a public lifetime commitment is a violation of human dignity. The media does not have to accept the right-wing's frames, and in state after state they have not. What can a reporter ask besides, "Do you support gay marriage?" Try this. Do you think the government should tell people who they can and can't marry? Or do you think the freedom to marry who you want to is a matter of equal rights under the law? Or do you see marriage as the realization of love in a lifetime commitment? Or does it benefit society when two people who are in love want to make a public lifetime commitment to each other? Morally based framing is everybody's job, especially reporters. It has long been right-wing strategy to repeat over and over phrases that evoke their frames and define issues their way. Such repetition makes their language normal everyday language and their frames normal everyday ways to think about issues. Reporters have an obligation to notice when they are being taken for a ride, and they should refuse to go along. It is a duty of reporters not to accept such a situation and not to simply use right-wing frames that have come to seem natural. And it is the special duty of reporters to study framing and to learn to see through politically motivated frames.